Ghosts of the Past by Christopher Vierspeek. Chapter 1.
I'm in hell. I'm on Hellview. Except it isn't called that yet. But that's what it is. A heat ray lances into the ammo containers to my right, and I scramble out of the dugout, yelling at the others to follow me as I go. I escape death by milliseconds as the frag grenades ignite in the superheat, and the little shelter my team carved out of the mud is filled with spinning shards of white-hot metal. I am lucky. I had just run back to my squad's position, relaying orders from the commander that we were to hold tight when the enemy attacked, so it was easier for me to get back out again. Last in, first out. The other men who were in with me, the men I had trained, marched, and bled with, are all gone now. They're dust, carried away by the hot wind that blows across the scarred surface of this world. Rockets and lasers, and the roaring contrails of rockets fill the skies above me as I crawl away, and burnt air fills my lungs. The noise is deafening, and the lights threaten to blind. From my right comes the heavy laser fire, and the sound of mortars and heavy shell systems. Blue lines stitch out into the smoky haze of the enemy's position. From my left, the lines of tracer and flashes of detonation are answered with red and white lines of heat, and even more powerful laser weapons. Weapons I can barely imagine, can barely believe exist. They are inhuman. Plumes of dirt erupt around me, and I'm showered in debris as it falls back to the ground. I scramble across on my hands and knees. I am an ant on an anthill that crumbles all around me, frantically trying to avoid the foot of an angry god as he stamps out the world. My armor and uniform snags on broken weaponry and shell casings, and my gloves get tangled in sharp razor wire and dead soldiers. There is another dugout ahead, maybe 10 yards away. I crawl towards it, head low, muscles tight. Suddenly, shooting stops, and so do I. Immobilized by the silence, all I can hear now is that hot wind, blowing thick strands of smoke across the battlefield like ghostly nets of gray. I can smell the DET powder and oil and blood that marks every field of war. It stings my nose, and I feel tears filling my eyes. Then, walking through the smoke, I see them. Dark silhouettes moving across the no man's land towards me. There are dozens of them. They are humanoid, but more squat than a man, and broader in the shoulders. Their armor is all encasing, thick, angular plates that look almost boxy in the pale morning light. It appears functional, simple even, but this is the hallmark of our enemy, simple on the surface, cunningly engineered beneath. This armor, the enemy's strength, their weaponry, everything about them is more sophisticated and powerful than anything we could have imagined. I know their weapons will split me apart like a grape in a fist if I stay still any longer. I push off from where I was crouched.
Coming in, I yell.
I can see the helmets and backs of the men in the trench I'm trying to reach. I need to warn them I'm a friendly. Need to make sure I don't cheat death by alien hands, only to die on the end of a human soldier's bayonet or pistol. I have to warn them, to tell them to move, to get out, to fire at the advancing enemy. All I can manage is to drag myself along on my stomach, my fingers digging handholds in the wet dirt to haul my exhausted and terrified body along. None of them turn as I slide into the shelter on my chest plate, dark red mud piling up between my collar and my chin. I spit some out of my mouth as I roll onto my back and lay in the little trench, panting, sweating, and swearing. Still no one moves. I force myself up on my feet again, unslinging my rifle and checking it as armed and ready to fire. I'm horrified to see the ammo counter now reads empty.
Someone give me a charger quick, I say.
The men in the trench are all facing out towards the advancing enemy, and I notice now their rifles are also slung or set on the ground beside them.
Hey, I say. What's going on? Stand to!
I grab the nearest soldier by the shoulder. I don't understand why they aren't shooting. The enemy are less than 20 yards from our lines now. Why is there no artillery support either? I turn the man around, but when he faces me, he has no face. Just a skull, a leering, empty rictus grin of whitened teeth, below 2 empty sockets. I throw the corpse to the ground and grab the next man. He too is already dead, and has been for a long time. I turn the others around one by one, panic setting in. Because they are all dead. All these men I fought with on Hellview are dead. I am alone. I am too late. I could not save them. No, not quite alone. I hear a soft humming noise above me, and I look up from the bones of the dead on the floor of the trench to see the enemy has arrived. Despite being barely half my height, he looms over me as he stands on the edge of the trench. His armor is a pale gold, where it's not smeared with blood and mud. It is plain, but up close I can see hints of intricacy beneath it. On his chest plate is a single emblem, a sigil, perhaps a unit marking. It looks like a dragon, snarling, with lips pulled back to reveal curved, golden teeth. Its jaws are open, stretched wide around the outline of a planet. He raises the barrel of his weapon and aims it at me. I am paralyzed by fear as I watch it start to glow red, and I hear a building, whining tone. The mouth of the weapon seems to transform as it gets hotter, growing fangs and deep red eyes, becoming the monster on its owner's armor. I want to turn and run, but it's too late. The beast roars at me, bathing me in heat and blinding me forever. I awaken, sweating but not screaming. Not this time, at least. The nightmares aren't new. I've been having them ever since the corporation rotated me out of frontline service and into the fleet, really. Sometimes they're about the actual battles I fought in. Sometimes they're more random. Sometimes they're a mix, like the one I'm trying to forget right now. Feels like they've gotten worse recently, though, and I think I might not be the only person aboard having them. I've seen the sunken eyes on some of the crew, and tempers have seemed unusually short recently. People are on edge. Perhaps that's not surprising, given the job we have to do today. The people we have to do it with. Yesterday's adversary is today's opportunity. I think I saw that one on some corporate literature once. The vid screen is already on, lighting up my quarters with a promo for a new colony freighter that's breaking orbit in the next few days. They're always recruiting for those things, calling for bold young adventurous types to go out and seize whatever new world the GCPS has claimed. I was one of them, once. I left my home world at 18, eager to escape the mundanity of life on a second sphere world. Corporate space was growing fast, lots of new worlds to explore and stake a claim on, so I joined a corporate military. The recruiting sergeant promised me action and adventure for the rest of my life. What he didn't tell me was that life could also be really, really short. But I did my time and survived it, mostly intact. I saw lots of worlds, but Hellview, that was the end for me. After that place, I rotated out of frontline service and into the merchant arm. I roll out of my bunk, stagger into the cubicle, and go through my ablutions, a routine ingrained by years in the military. Wash, shave, teeth, basic hygiene, nothing fancy. A woman I knew gave me some kind of perfume years ago. I think she worked for the factory that made it, so she got it cheap. It sits unused, gathering dust and grime under my mirror, just like me. I wash the dried sweat away, but I leave the perfume alone. I'm Captain John Turney, veteran. I'm supposed to be rough around the edges. Instead, I throw some painkillers from the clean glass bottle on the other side of the sink down my throat and wash them down with Caff from the auto dispenser beside my bunk. The intercom on the bulkhead whistles, and I wince at the pain in my head. I hit the answer button with my palm.
Yeah?
Captain, it's the freighter. You better get down here. They're early.
I clear my throat, feeling the painkiller start to kick in.
Acknowledged. On my way.
I dress, a pair of fatigues, a jacket over my shirt, and leave my quarters. The vid screen is now showing a commercial for the same painkillers I use. It makes me feel good to know I'm supporting the company. The Harridan is not a huge ship, not compared to long-distance haulers that pull most of the goods around the GCPS space, at subliminal speeds anyways. But there are still a few decks between me and the dock. No elevator, though. So I have to slide down a few ladders and open and reseal a few pressure hatches along the way. The sounds of the ship are all around me as I do. The hum of power conduits, the hiss of cooling fluids, the rattle of life support. There's a maze between the decks of the ship, miles of pipe and wiring keeping us going through space. We are about as big as you can be and still use a McKinley drive to slide along gravity wells between systems, and just big enough to accommodate the Forgefather vessel that is touching down in the bay as I get there. The sturdy grip looks like a pile of metal bricks as it settles on the deck. Long, flat sides, layers of thick armor, literally bristling, with more than a dozen heavy weapon emplacements. But I also know that its engines, though smaller, are more powerful than ours, and its weaponry could quite easily blow us out of the sky. Simple on the surface, cunningly engineered beneath. There's still a lot we don't know about them, but power seems to be the only thing the Forgefathers respect. We showed them we had power on worlds like Hellview, refused to back down, showed them how far we'd go to win. Because of that, these days we're trading partners. The Forgefathers marching down their ship's loading ramp now are still fully armored, though. There are seven of them that I can see. Six are in pairs, pulling heavy-looking crates that move along the deck on suspensor fields. Corporate space, human space, is a big place with lots of worlds, and there are nearly as many individual corporations within it. They make everything from starships to wall planners, and there are plenty that make guns and explosives to supply the various private military forces the corporations run, including my ship. But none of the armaments we make are as good as the ones the Forge Fathers turn out. One of the dwarfs approaches me. His helmet hangs from his waist, and his white-bearded face is lined with creases, but also open and friendly. I wonder for a moment how many centuries he has seen. He smiles and extends a hand. I let my front knee bend a little as I match the gesture.
John Turney, I say. Welcome aboard the Harridan.
His hand is strong and bigger than mine and more calloused. Forge Father leaders still work for a living. I like and respect that about them.
Thank you, Captain. You can call me Brooklyn. We're a little off schedule, I know. So thank you for letting us aboard.
After a moment, I realize he's just given me what amounts to an apology for not being strictly on time. The dwarves are sticklers for detail. Of course, we're more than happy to get underway sooner. The dwarf grunts as he watches the others return to their ship and pull more of the crates down from their hold.
Got somewhere else you'd rather be?
He says. Let's just say I'd rather not hang around in this neighborhood any longer than I have to. This kind of cargo, the GCPS prefers it to stay away from the more civilized spheres and the core, so it gets done on the fringe. We're uncomfortably close to the Death Ark, and rumor has it there are worse things than pirates on the loose out there. A dozen crates have been brought out of the dwarf ship now, and another Forge Father approaches us. He hands me a data screen, and I press my thumb to it. The implant beneath my skin registers with a device. The receipt of the cargo acknowledged. The dwarf walks back to his ship. Brooklyn turns to me and extends his hand again, and I take it, but without looking. I am transfixed watching the Forge Father with the data screen as he walks away from me and ascends the ramp into his ship again.
I'd say it was a pleasure, but let's not overstate things.
Brooklyn says, a nod agreement, and then he's gone. The ship's ramp closes, and its repulse engines light up. It maneuvers towards the exit port as server mechs wheel out of their compartment to move the crates into secure storage areas. I head for my quarters again, ignoring DeFreitas as she tries to ask me for orders. Back in my cubicle, I swallow more painkillers and grip the basin with white knuckles as I stare at myself in the mirror above it. The armor looked different from how I remember it, how I dream it so many nights. But that sigil, a dragon swallowing the world. The Forge Fathers I fought in Hellview wore it, and so did the one that I just saw in my hold. It was him. It had to be him. But it couldn't be. We killed them all.
Chapter 2.
Their enemy are alert. They know the assault is coming. They are well prepared and well drilled. Their plans are solid. Each one knows them perfectly. They stand in perfectly spaced ranks, their positions calculated to give them the best lanes of fire, and optimal cover to protect their compound, and the valuable merchandise at its center. They are robots, built to fight and programmed to kill. They wait. Their opponents approach quickly, using their jetpacks to bound up the sides of the building, between their step-off point and the objective, and leap over low obstacles in the roads. Their speed would be considered reckless if they were any other collection of individuals, but these are enforcers. Every one of them is the finest soldier mankind has yet produced, and carries the best equipment money can buy, because nothing but the best is good enough for the will of the Council personified. They were also built to fight and programmed to kill, but they are not robots. Epsilon-3-1's unit talks and jokes as it reaches the roof of the tallest building they could find overlooking the target compound. 3-10 is the newest member of the assault team, and finds rich material in a number of replacement parts some of the more seasoned veterans have in place their original organics. He is first to the summit and turns around, offering a mocking, helpful hand to 3-4. A veteran operator 3-10 knows has had one of his legs replaced several times in recent operations. 3-4 waves him off. He is still just as combat efficient as any rookie, and they all know the new guy will carry his own scars soon enough. The enforcers did not bother to make their approach to the target covert. Making noise is all part of the plan. The banter is necessary too, for other reasons. It is a bonding thing, natural for elite warriors, but as the teams settle into their insertion point, and their conditioning starts to kick in, it stops. To 3-1 it feels as if the color drains out of the world somehow.
but his vision does not fade or blur at all. Rather, it becomes, if anything, sharper. Where a normal man might have felt fear, looking from the top of a 3-story building at a walled compound full of enemies that will soon be trying to kill him, 3-1 now feels nothing. Maybe some anticipation, maybe a little eagerness, but instead of threats, he sees only opportunities. He is also aware of his enemy's strengths, but he sees their weaknesses too. It feels like someone has peeled off the top of 3-1's skull and poured liquid coolant around his brain. All that matters now is that it is the will of the council that 3-1 takes the primary objective from the bunker at the center of the compound, whatever the cost. All other objectives are secondary. The tech in his armor works in tandem with the tech built into his brain and body, readying him for action. As he looks around himself, he sees the glowing outlines of the other operators and their numeric designators. Stimulant reservoirs open, ready to boost the power and energy in his musculature. And he realizes now he is desperate to move, to begin the assault, to destroy something, to show how good he is at his job. Finally, all disposition lights in 3-1's visor turn green. The counter in the corner of his view counts down to 0. There is no need for any further signal from command. Every asset is ready and in position, so 3-1 and his unit leap from the edge of the rooftop and engage their jetpacks. As they do, heavy weapons teams on the floors below fire their rocket launchers and burst lasers, and a squadron of 3 GR-77 Striders breaks from an alley and marches towards the compound's main gate. The heavy weapons don't do much damage to the compound walls, but they are not expected to. They keep the defenders' heads down and give the slower-moving GR-77s the chance to get across the open ground between them and the gate. The Striders' guns are powerful, but it's not until 2 of the giant walkers each raise a heavy leg and together kick the doors off their hinges that the entry is breached. Enforcers on foot, firing their Genling rifles, guns that are too heavy for a normal human to wield effectively, surge forward from cover, dropping targets along the walls as they run. 3-1 does not see this. His units have already cleared the gate, and although his helmet notifies him that one of the Striders has been brought down by concentrated fire from one of the watchtowers along the wall, it does not change the plan at all. The jetpacks are not powerful enough for true flight. It is more of a controlled fall, but their starting elevation and momentum mean the assault unit has covered some distance and built up considerable speed as they come to ground outside the entrance to the bunker. Most of the defenders have been successfully drawn to the gate, but there are still a dozen more waiting for them. Several are crushed under the assault unit's heavy armored feet, and then 3-1 and his men have to fight hard to clear their landing zone. A dozen mechs, humanoids with thick armored torsos on powerful legs, go down to headshots from the unit's 32 HLP-X pistols, the blasts exploding from the back of their skull casings in showers of sparks and metallic fragments. The defenders regroup quickly, pouring out of the building on the far side of the bunker. This is the point where 3-1, when he was just a man, before his induction into the Corps, before his training and enhancements, might have felt panic, as he and the men with him are surrounded by a swarm of cold-eyed monsters, with no relief in sight. But he is not just a man anymore. The Corps broke him down and rebuilt him, harder, stronger, colder, and more deadly than any monster he has had to face since, so he does not feel panic, or indeed any other emotion. Instead, he deploys his Dionatech combat blade from its sheath on his left arm and charges into combat. The others do the same. The blades are straight-edged and look like gladii ancient fighters might use, perhaps only useful for short stabbing motions. But they have a mono-molecular edge, and backed up by Enforcer's enhanced strength and reflexes, they make light work of the defender's armor. This is what must be done now. Fight, slash, stab, kill. 3-1 dodges a volley of laser fire and plunges his blade in the chest of a mech, withdraws it, drives his elbow into the optics of another mech, shoots a third as he tries to gut him with its blade. The fighting is not one-sided, though. 3-7 takes a shot to the chest and collapses, a neat section drilled through his plastron. 3-5 turns the mech's momentum against it and destroys its brain core with his blade, but then staggers as his armor absorbs the shot to his upper back. More mechs, a reserve force, appear from within the bunker. Their weapons, a mix of solid shot and lasers, are built into their frames, and they fire into the melee, shredding several of their fellow robots when they do. This is a new tactic, something the Enforcers have not seen this branded defender do before. Apparently there is nothing the enemy will not do to win the engagement, and 3-4 is caught out. The robot he was in the process of eviscerating is cut down by a hail of heavy shots, and 2 of the rounds impact 3-4. One cracks his femur, and there is a shower of blood from the joint between his right arm and shoulder, where the other hits him. 3-1 knows his teammate will be annoyed about the loss of his leg again when the battle is over. For now, though, he does not call out, but he does drop to one knee as the blood coagulates on his armor. The other operators do not hesitate. They turn this new wrinkle into their advantage, maneuvering to place more of the robots between themselves and the reinforcements. They pivot and duck until there is a wall of metal obscuring them completely from incoming fire, using the bodies of the dead defenders as shields. When the ground team arrives, shooting their way through the defenders at the gates and fighting to catch up with the assault team, the extra firepower turns the tide of the battle until eventually all the defenders are taken down. 3 members of Team 3 have been wounded, 2 of them severely, but there is now nothing between them and the entrance to the bunker. This is when the defenders play their last card. From the darkened entrance emerge 3 humans. The mechs have hostages, held in the most secure place in their compound. 2 males and 1 female are marched out, blinking in the dusty sunlight. Each one is held close by a mech. He uses his other arm to hold a gun to its captive's head. One of the males speaks, his voice sounding stressed and cracking under the strain of what he's enduring.
"Please, don't shoot! They say they'll let us go if you pull back now!"
The enforcers do not move, but they do not lower their weapons either. The hostages look tense. One of them starts to cry. 3-1 can see 3-10 moving slowly around the side of the bunker, behind the mechs, and the other operators signal their readiness. Even 3-4, kneeling, tells him he is now combat effective, his wounds managed adequately. 3-10 has his pistol aimed at the back of one of the mech's heads now, and he signals 3-1 he wishes to take the shot.
"Hold,"
3-1 says, and the other operators obey. A series of explosions rock the ground around the bunker then, and through the rubble of a collapsing building to 3-1's side stride 4 bulky shapes, Team 4, enforcers in peacekeeper armor. Their armor is among the heaviest available to the Corps, and carries some of its most powerful weapons. But that weight makes them slower, too, and they need time to reach the primary from their own insertion point. A timer in 3-1's vision tells them they are still running with an acceptable variance of the plan. As they clear the debris, the robots holding the hostages swivel to face them. One of the robots lowers its weapon, the barrel now pointing towards the peacekeepers. The female hostage screams.
"Now,"
3-1 says. The peacekeepers immediately open fire, pouring heavy beams into the group outside the bunker. 3-1's unit and the other strike teams with them open up too, annihilating the 6 figures, cutting them down in a merciless fusillade of blue fire. Sparks fly as the robots are destroyed, and smoking chunks of neocrete are blasted from the walls behind where they stood. The enforcers fire until there's nothing left moving outside the bunker. When it is done, 3-1 sends 3-10 inside. The rookie returns a few moments later with the primary objective held in his hands. It's a small red flag, and he waves it above his head, from side to side, and a siren sounds across the compound. The op is over. Another training mission against robotic defenders successfully completed. The primary objective has been secured exactly according to plan. Teams of medtechs drift into the area on hovering platforms and move towards the wounded operators, as those still standing go through their post-op procedures, unloading their weapons and gradually coming out of their combat state. 3-1 walks over to a pile of broken mech parts on the ground outside the bunker and kneels down amongst them. He has sheathed his blade, and he pulls a few blasted components apart, identifying them as he does. He finds parts of the secondaries too, also robots made to look as much like real humans as possible, but still robots. He can see a human-sized torso and what looks like entrails and blood spilling from it, and for a moment, he feels something twist in his own gut. It's as if something is wriggling inside him, and some kind of color, red maybe, seems to creep into the edges of his vision. Then he feels a familiar trickle of coolness spread through his body, starting from somewhere near the base of his skull. It is calming, numbing, and pleasant. He looks closer and realizes it's simply wiring and hydraulic tubing he is holding. 3-1 walks over to where several techs are going to work on 3-7. Stripping off his armor and pumping various chemicals into the access points on his upper spine. This is a good sign. This much effort signifies they believe the operator can be saved and sent back to a team. A paramedics have pulled 3-4 to his feet and are guiding him, limping, towards a transport, where the rest of the unit is waiting for him. A signal flashes up on 3-1's visor, summoning him and the other team leaders to a debriefing session, and 3-1 is glad, feels actually happy. This is the last training mission on his rotation, and he knows he will most likely receive his unit's new duty assignment at the debriefing. He hopes it will be a combat mission. He knows all units in Epsilon are ready for it. As the unit mounts its transport and glides out of the battle zone,
3-10 asks him whether he thinks it would be possible to save the hostages as well as the primary objective of securing the bunker. Maybe, he tells him. Maybe in a real live op they could have secured the hostages alive, but then again, maybe not. Perhaps the enemy would have used the time while they stood there negotiating to call up more reserves. Perhaps they would just have taken the chance to kill more enforcers as soon as their guard was down. But none of this matters. Enforcers don't exist for theoreticals and maybes. Those are for the officers and planners to work out. Enforcers exist only to carry out their mission they are given. Nothing more, nothing less. The hostages were not the mission, just part of the plan. The enforcers need only carry out the will of the council, whatever the cost. All other objectives are secondary.
Chapter 3.
Straggle reached a long, thin arm into the gap under the panel until he was in it up to his shoulder. He had to roll onto his back then, exposing his belly to get the right angle. But the crawlway was so narrow, he had needed to leave his armor at the entrance, so there was no way anybody else could get near enough to him to hurt him, and he was so close now. He bent his arm at the elbow, his whiskers twitching in the darkness as he felt around with his finger for the screws. There they were, three of them, near the top of the panel. He went to work, twisting and rolling the screw heads with the tips and sides of his digits until they came loose, but quietly. No sense in getting caught now. He had outwitted the Maligni already. Those ugly, arrogant Maligni, the ones who had sneered at him all his life. They looked down on every brethren pupped into the lower castes. They thought they were so clever. Just because they had the fortune to be born a Malignus, they could make nice weapons and good armor, it was true. Back before the mother had decided it was time to travel, to board a human starship and fly anyway. But here, on the ship, on a long journey between where they had come from and wherever they were going, what did they do? Nothing but eat food the brethren fetched for them. And then they had taken the mother away from them. The final screw fell loose and clattered down onto the metal vent surface before Straggle could catch it in his paw. He lay there silently for a moment, his right ear trapped between his shoulder and the panel, but his left ear straining in anticipation, listening for any reaction to the noise. But there was none. All he could hear were the normal sounds of the ship's pumping systems, sighing deep and slow, like a mother's breath, and the slow rotation of its core. Straggle slowly let his breath out. He withdrew his arm and wriggled back onto his belly. Then he gently pushed the now free access panel clear and eased his body and ragged tail into the next space on his journey. Three more panels and he would see her again, and them. It wasn't fair. He had tried to be respectful, but the Maligni had still stopped him. They called him names, hissing at him spitefully, and then tore apart the offering he had brought. It had been a blanket, a human one, well made and carefully pilfered from a container Straggle had chewed his way into in one of the cargo holds. At great personal risk, too. He had gone there during the day cycle on the ship, the time when the human crew was most active. He had been so desperate to see her again. The mother had birthed on the voyage before, adding more brethren to the nest, but when her time had come this time, something was different. The Maligni had been agitated, and had moved her from the nest's great chamber beneath the heat exchanger on the seventh deck, to an even more remote place, behind and below it, a place with only one entrance, and they would not allow any of her brethren to see her. When she had finally given birth, her shrieks had nearly driven the brethren mad. They had all heard her call out before, but this was different. She made sounds that seemed to be not just heard, but felt, deep in their skulls. Eventually she had stopped, and they had all calmed down, but Straggle had nearly chewed all the way through his tail, as he fought the urge to tear out the throats of his fellow brethren. Even some of the human crew, the ones Straggle watched as they went about their business, had seemed more irritable in the days around the birthing. Life had gone back to more or less normal since then, but Straggle had found himself almost consumed by the need to see the new litter. To see the mother again, of course, but mostly this new litter that called out to him in the night while he slept. His tail thrashed from side to side and small growls escaped his open mouth. He was nearly there now. The Maligni had secluded the mother in a chamber that only had one entrance, it was true, but it is also true that there was always another way in for the brethren. Life for the brethren was all about survival, especially on a starship like this one. Survival here meant becoming an expert at being above, below, and all around the humans that ran it, without ever being seen. Straggle was very good at surviving, one of the best of the brethren when it came to finding ways around the ship. It was how he had got his name. As a pup, he had always been wandering off from the rest of the litter. They thought he was lagging behind, a straggler, but in fact he was exploring. He had found every loose access panel, every unsecured hatch and conduit, every crawl space and drop shaft, and way in and out of the ship since they had first clawed aboard, and now he had found a second way into the new birthing chamber. He had gone under the nest, the empty auxiliary fuel pod the Maligni had disconnected from the rest of the system, and through the wastewater containers. This had not been pleasant, but once through the thick soup of stinking waste, high liquid, he had been able to access an empty space that ran almost all the way from the ship's belly to its upper decks. Then he doubled back on himself, sliding along a narrow cable duct, removing panels as he went, until he was here, 10 feet above the cavity in which the Maligni had sequestered the mother and her newest offspring. He slowly pushed aside the broken grillwork at the top of the bulkhead section that made up the rear wall of the space, and dropped down into the chamber. It was warm in here, and smelled good. Straggle's nose twitched from side to side as he tested the air. No sign of any interfering Maligni. He could smell her, though. A comforting odor, slightly bitter, like old cheese and engine oil, that suggested comfort and care and food. There was another smell, too, familiar and odd at the same time. It had to be the new litter. The mother was sleeping, and through the gloom Straggle could see her bulk laid out on her side. The newborns appeared to be by her belly. It was a peaceful, quiet scene. Straggle remembered his own time as a pup being more chaotic, almost a constant struggle for survival, a time that served to prepare the young brethren for the hard life ahead of them. This litter seemed to be taking a much easier path, and Straggle wondered for a moment whether it was possible a mother had birthed a litter of runts, weak infants that would not survive long enough to leave her. He crept forward, eager to see them anyway. The whispers in his head told him to. He was only a few feet from them, crawling low on his haunches so as not to draw attention or appear threatening, when he noticed the entire litter had white fur. He had never seen a completely white brethren before. Some had patches. Straggle himself had an almost entirely white belly, and he knew that if he managed to survive long enough, his fur might turn gray as it aged, but all white was something new. He was beside the litter now, and he realized the coloring was not the only unusual thing about this litter. He could see all their heads, as many as he had fingers on one paw, plus his ears, but instead of being piled together, sharing body heat like his own litter had done, they seemed to be arranged in a neat circle. Their heads lay at its outside, with their tails wrapped closely around each other in the center. He sniffed and peered more closely at this arrangement. His eyes widened as he realized the tails were actually fused together, a knot of bone and flesh that unified every little body in the litter. One of the pups moved then, and Straggle jumped back quickly, startled. He was still curious, though, eager to meet this strange new brethren with their odd color and tangled tails. So he crouched down again and creeped back forwards. The pup, awakened, perhaps by hunger or because it smelled Straggle, slowly opened its eyes and lifted its head to face him. Straggle whimpered slightly as he saw the tiny creature had no eyes, only 2 black sockets, scabbed over with dried blood. But somehow it saw him anyway, and it felt as if Straggle's world suddenly ended. His body collapsed to the ground and lay there, his legs and arms twitching and pawing at the floor convulsively, while a jaundiced yellow foam leaked from the corners of his mouth. His mind was still active, though, still conscious as the Veerman pup spoke inside his head. It was several voices, but spoke as one. The joining of their tails had linked the pup's minds as well as their bodies. Even the sleeping ones were present in his head now, whispering to him and showing him things. First they showed him their birth, the pain of it, all of them coming at once. The mother had nearly died from the pain, but they showed him the Maligni faces too, eager and excited at the advent of this omen in their nest. They called it a tangle, and they were very special to the Maligni, both a warning and a signal. The Maligni were the last thing the tangle saw before all its eyes were scratched out. The birth of a tangle meant great things for the nest that raised them, and great prestige for their mother, but they would be hated too, reviled by other nests, rival tangles. They had to be protected and kept safe from harm, taken somewhere deep and dark where nothing could get to them. Straggle heard the discussion amongst the Maligni after they blinded the tangle. One had wanted to try and take the ship immediately, to kill the humans aboard it and steer the ship to somewhere safe. Others spoke more reasonably, pointing out that they didn't know how to steer the ship, or indeed exactly where they were in the galaxy, so they decided to wait, to keep the mother and the tangle safe in their birthplace, until the next omen revealed itself.
Next, the tangle showed him the future. It was a vision of fire and death. He was on the ship still, and it had flown near a sun, its light filling the viewing windows on the left side. He saw himself in one of the upper corridors, but in the open, unafraid, no longer skulking in the dark and hidden places. He felt the comfort of the sun's warmth. He saw now there were other brethren there too, all of them basking in the warm yellow glow. But then everything was thrown into darkness. A shadow fell over them, the shade of something so big it blotted out the light from the sun. It was vast and formless, nameless, yet it seemed somehow familiar to Straggle. Or was it the tangle that recognized the vast evil that had come for it? A racial memory passed down through the genes of the Veermen since their creation. Whatever it was, it scared Straggle, and in the real world, a stream of urine escaped him and pooled on the floor around his prone body. He saw himself alone on the deck then, exposed and terrified by the shadow looming over him. It descended on him quickly, and he felt himself being consumed by it. He squealed as the thing tore him apart, until there was nothing left but blackness. When light returned to Straggle's world, he found himself in an air vent. Through the slats in the side, he could see the ship's main hangar bay to his right. His fractured mind could not remember how he had gotten back out of the birthing chamber, or collecting his armor, or how he had gotten all the way from the bowels of the ship to the bay. It did not matter. Nothing mattered now but escape. Survival. A klaxon was sounding, and he heard the hiss and thump of the heavy hydraulics as the external doors of the bay slid open. Another ship began to move into view, its nose easing inside the bay, and Straggle crawled faster towards the end of the vent. Ships often visited here, but they never stayed for long. At the vent's end, he peered through the mesh and sniffed at the air being carried to him. Humans, machine parts, exhaust gases. Then, something else, something bad. He suppressed a hiss as the new ship's ramp lowered and several short armored forms walked down it. Stunted men. He had seen and smelled them before, and he knew they were probably more dangerous than the humans of the Harridan. For a moment he was torn. Here was the mother, the brethren, the familiar runs and lairs and food. On the stunted men's ship was unknown danger, danger he would face alone. But the tangle was here too, and the vision it had shown him. As he remembered the shadow and its teeth and claws, he squeaked very quietly, and all reason was driven from him. Something horrible was coming to the Harridan, and Straggle knew he didn't want to be here when it arrived. Whatever was on the stunted men's ship, it had to be better than that. He would have to be quick, though, sneak aboard while the stunted men talked with the humans. He could see an intake valve open at the rear of the ship, not far, easy enough to skitter from the shadow to shadow until he reached it. So as the stunted men went about their business, unloading heavy crates onto the deck of the Harridan, Straggle began to twist open the screws at the rear of the vent panel.
Chapter 4.
The sturdy grip moved away from the Harridan at a modest speed. The secrets of Ford Father technology were closely guarded, so even giving away how fast the cutter could really move was undesirable. The pilot did not even take her out in her true final heading, waiting until Brooklyn had marched back onto the bridge before adjusting course.
"Report,"
he said. The pilot peered closely at one of the screens on the bank of instruments in front of him.
"Aye, they were scanning us all the way. The usual stuff, though. Infrared, some light data hacks, pulse readings, nothing we can handle."
Brooklyn grunted.
"Good, good."
He was neither surprised nor truly offended to hear the crew of the corporation ship he had just left had tried to hack into his own ship's secure systems. Some degree of skullduggery was only normal when you dealt with humans, after all. Since the first peace pacts had been signed, the GCPS and Star Realm had also agreed to numerous trade treaties. The humans supplied material and luxury goods from their numerous factory colonies and harvester outlets, and the Forge Fathers supplied advanced tech and components to help support corporate growth, but there was also the somewhat less well-publicized arms trade to consider. Officially, the GCPS expanded through peaceful negotiations and welcomed all newly discovered words into the fold, but the truth was that the universe is a dangerous place, and the GCPS would only grow with dangerous men at the helm. So the Forge Fathers also supplied them the armor needed to keep those men alive. The arrangement was a beneficial one for both sides. The Council needed suits for their enforcer program. Mandrake had taken care of that.
and the Forge Fathers were happy to have another race take the field for them against threats such as those found in the ruins of the Asterian Star Empire. But trade came easier than trust. Every suit of enforcer armor supplied to the Council also had built-in fail-safes, kill switches that would destroy the armor before anyone could reverse-engineer it and steal the secrets of dwarf technology for themselves. The enforcers would have power, but only as much as the Forge Lords allowed them. That didn't mean they didn't try. The Star Realm was well aware that GCPS would go to almost any length to find a way around those failsafes. Being scanned by the corporate ships they delivered goods to, like the Herodin, was therefore only to be expected. Brooklyn realized he would have been more offended if they hadn't tried to hack his ship. Something else was bothering him, though. He watched the turning starfield outside the grip's viewports as he thought back to the interaction he had had with the human captain. Something was off about it. Something about the name, perhaps? John Turney. He couldn't get a grip on it, a maddening thing for any Forge Lord worth his mettle.
"Do me a favor,"
he said to his crew chief.
"Don't take us home just yet. Go slow and run the full surface sweep. Send out some dogs if you have to."
"Aye?"
"Aye."
"What are we looking for?"
"I'm not rightly sure. I just have a bad feeling about this. It might be nothing but humor, old dwarf. Aye?"
"All right."
"Shout me if you find anything. I'll be in my forge."
Brooklyn left the pilot to it and headed towards his quarters and the sanctuary of his private work area on the ship's mid-deck. His helmet clanked softly against his hip as he walked, and he lost himself for a moment in the tapping rhythm. He hummed a soft tune to himself as he descended a ramp towards the crew areas, a camp song he had learned some time ago on a campaign distant in both space and time. He rounded the final corner to his destination when the communicator in his suit whistled softly to him.
"What?"
he said.
"You were right. We found something."
It was his pilot. Brooklyn smiled. It always paid to check your rings when you shook hands with a human.
"What is it? I'm betting on a surface tracker."
"Well, you'd lose that one then. It's not a tracker. It's a stowaway."
Brooklyn swore loudly as he detached his helmet from his belt. If there was one thing he disliked more than humans, it was the vermin they carried everywhere with them. Forge Father technology was far in advance of anything many other races in the galaxy could even dream of. Part of this sophistication came from dwarves living much longer than those of other races, and thus having more time to work with, but mostly it came from their attention to detail and willingness to go to painstaking lengths to get the absolute most of whatever material they were working with, or to follow a strand of research as far as it took them. Their ships were faster and more powerful than just about anything in the galaxy, but a starship is still a starship, and the bowels of the sturdy grip were just as dirty and noisy as any others. Brooklyn's helm shut out most of the noise, but he could still feel the waves of pressure buffeting his armor as he stalked along the narrow corridors in the power plant. The static they produced was playing havoc with the armor's sensors, too, but he didn't want to have them powered down, lest it warn his quarry he was on the trail. Little chance of being caught out, though. The cybermastiffs at his heels would make sure of that. He kept a small kennel aboard his ship, just the three dogs. They were only partially robotic, with stronger jaws and reinforced skulls. All the good stuff you needed in a quality fighting dog. Their olfactory centers were pure organic, though. No sense in messing with perfection. The noise from the core meant he couldn't hear them growling as he neared a sealed junction, but the threat indicators in his visor started to glow a soft amber, responding to relays in the dog's collars. He smiled and rested a hand on the hatch controls.
"On your mark, lads,"
he said. The hounds were all on edge, straining to get at whatever they had smelt in the room beyond. He keyed in the access code, and the door slid open.
"On you go."
The dogs darted through the open hatch, old Barter in the lead, his brothers, Biter and Bit, at his flanks. Brooklyn stepped through behind them and let the door slide closed. The noise from the core room was shut out instantly, and Brooklyn could hear considerably more in the compartment he had entered. His helmet readout was still being scrambled by the core, though, and the lights were out too, no doubt thanks to the unwanted visitor the scan had detected. He switched on night vision sensors and scanned the space ahead of him slowly. It was a storage area, full of racks of spare parts and components for the engines and forges aboard the ship. There, at the opposite end of the room, he could see the three locator signals of his hounds. They were agitated, that much was obvious, but whether they were engaged or not was unclear. Then one of the signals winked out completely.
"Hell,"
he said, and started to move forwards, unstrapping his hammer from his side. He was 10 meters away from the hounds when the second signal stopped transmitting, and he picked up his pace, running through the darkness now, his feet pounding a metallic tattoo across the deck plating. Ahead of him, a pile of crates had been built up in a recessed alcove in the storage bay. The hound's signal was coming from behind it. He charged into the crate, swinging his hammer over his head, and bringing the energized core down hard. The packing materials and contents burst into a shower of fragments, bouncing off his armor and onto the deck around him. A single Veerman stood on the other side of the wreckage, its eyes glowing softly in the infrared light from Brooklyn's armor. Its tail was ragged, looking almost broken near the end, and there were several bleeding bite marks on its flanks. You could hear it squealing now, and the harsh growling of one of the dogs. It looked like Bit, and it had the Veerman by one forearm and was trying to drag it to the ground. The bodies of the dog's brothers lay on each side of the rat thing, but there was no time to check if they were alive or not. The Veerman sprang at Brooklyn immediately, ignoring or forgetting the dog clamped onto it by its augmented jaws. Nothing would make the dog release its grip now, other than a direct command from its master. Although that would not kill whatever it latched onto, its weight would slow its victim down. Important when you're a relatively small and slow dwarf fighting a fast and agile Veerman in confined quarters on a ship's hold. And it was fast. It dodged to one side as Brooklyn brought his hammer down again, trying to split the rat man's skull open, and brought his own weapon, an evilly curved knife that looked like it had been chewed into shape, up towards Brooklyn's midsection. The blade glanced off the armor, and Brooklyn spun around to follow the Veerman as it tried to escape past him.
Oh, no you don't,
he grunted as he grabbed the Veerman's pink tail. It squealed again as Brooklyn squeezed hard and tried to yank the Veerman back and off its feet. Instead, the part of the tail he was holding broke off in his hand with a sharp snap, and the Veerman stumbled forward to the ground.
That's my dog you got there.
He hefted the hammer again, lining it up with the rat man's spine.
And this is my ship. No stowaways.
He swung the hammer down, and the weight of the thing coupled with its energy field easily plowed through the bulky armor of the Veerman. There was a squelching sound as its spine was pulped, and a spurt of red blood was driven from its mouth.
Ah, look now. You stained my decks.
Brooklyn tutted as he pulled his hammer back over the messy crater it made in the Veerman's back.
Come on now, you.
He gave the release signal to Bit, still grimly attached to the dead but twitching Veerman's arm.
Let's go see what he did to your brothers.
The dog barked at him and panted, happy it had done its job. As Brooklyn knelt down in the alcove, it was obvious old Barter had run his last scent. The dog's neck was broken, and its head lolled to one side as he picked it up. Biter had a nasty stab wound in his belly, but he was still breathing, and Brooklyn gently gathered him up with his other arm. Bit whined at his heel as he cradled the two animals in his arms.
I know, boy. I know. But he had a good long life, didn't he? And you'll be the top dog now, so I'll be needing you to step up.
The communicator whistled in Brooklyn's helm.
It's me again. We found something.
I know. I'm in the engine compartment. I got it.
What? Why? No, not that. We found something else.
Another Veerman?
Brooklyn frowned. If there was one thing he disliked more than hunting Veerman, it was hunting more Veerman.
No, nothing aboard the ship. It was the scans.
Go on.
Well, we kept scans running after we found the stowaway. To be honest, they were still for a deep level check, and I didn't see many point in stopping them.
Brooklyn could feel himself growing impatient, an unusual feeling for a dwarf.
Aye, and?
Back at our corporation ship, something got through the pulse field and they're scanning us. Into the central banks.
Brooklyn swore.
Hell's teeth.
This could be bad, and he knew it. To the GCPS, and as far as anyone else knew, the ward ships operated more or less randomly, traveling to wherever they were needed or a trade had been arranged. If anyone found out the truth, though, that their movements were in fact well-coordinated, that could leave them vulnerable. Then there was the fact of the true strength of the Star Realm, the military might they had hidden from the galaxy at large.
Bloody humans,
he said.
How much did they get?
Well, that's the problem. The approach they used, the sophistication, the sheer subtlety of their code strings. Well?
Well, what?
Well, there's no way it was the corporation I got in. I'm looking at the data here, and if I were a better man, I'd put good gold on it being a third party, an outside agent.
So you're saying...
Aye, someone else was at the meet. Someone we couldn't see.
Brooklyn cursed again. There was only one race he disliked more than humans, Veermen, and all the other races in the galaxy combined.
All right. Take us to the wired ship. The Forge Lords are going to want to know about this.
He looked down at his dogs again. The two living and the recently deceased.
Better get your boys back up to strength then,
he said.
I have a feeling we're going to be on the hunt again, and soon.
Chapter 5.
I believe the price was 500,000, Captain Turney?
Asks Wolf. He looks at me with those dark eyes and that thin-lipped smile, the credit chip held out towards me, and for a moment, I can't decide which I want to do more, kill this guy or run away screaming. We're in his lab. It's full of nice clean white fittings, and there are benches loaded with high-end gear and processors doing complicated stuff I probably wouldn't understand, being just a lowly ship's captain on a courier mission to the back end of nowhere and all. There are even some of those big round liquid stasis drums in there, filled with what looked like human limbs, but covered with weird cankerous growths. The doc looks the part too, in his clean white coat, buttoned up high under his chin, his black hair all slicked back, cut neat and tight. There's just something about this guy that gives me the creeps. It's like he's too clean somehow. There's not a speck of dirt on him, not a hair out of place. Reminds me of something a sergeant I knew in the CCM once said. The only clean people in the corporation are the ones who scrubbed a lot of dirt off. That guy's dead now, and I have a funny feeling I could be following him if I'm not careful here. No, Doc, I say, forcing politeness. The price we agreed on was 750,000. My gratitude and discretion comes free.
Of course,
says the doctor, bowing his head ever so slightly. He reprograms the chip and hands it to me again, and I take it, being careful not to make physical contact with his slender white hands. He holds onto the chip for a second longer than necessary, and those cold, dark eyes fix with mine.
Be assured, though, Captain Turney, your discretion is exactly what I am paying for.
Relax, Doctor, I say. Nobody will know I was ever here. The secrecy in this place is amazing. It's a black site. The black site, as far as I want to know. And officially, it does not exist. You hear rumors about places like this all the time in the GCPS, though. Places the Council sends its worst enemies. The people deemed too dangerous for holiday camps, like the prison on Peristia. The place all the really ugly tech gets researched and developed. But it's so far out of the way, you'd really only find it if you knew what you were looking for. Being inside a hollowed-out asteroid in the middle of nowhere helps with that. It took a few days to slide here from our meeting with the Grip. We traveled faster than light, better than light, just like the ads for the McKinley Drive say. And it's definitely the fastest mode of travel known to man. But you still have to navigate around little things like stars and planets. And there are only so many safe points you can slide to between where we picked up our cargo and where we are now. Then when we got here, the security was so tight I had to anchor the Harridan several hundred kilometers away and shuttle the cargo over here alone. No other crew allowed, and definitely no weapons. Most of the time, the stuff I collect from Forgefather ships goes direct to the Enforcers. I ferry it to their wyverns, sometimes out near the Death Arc, sometimes closer to the core. They won't collect it themselves. I guess they're afraid the Forgefathers might switch their armor off or something. But sometimes, just occasionally, I get told to bring it somewhere like this. Not an Enforcer in sight. Just lots of labs and techs and the occasional really creepy guy like Wolf. I don't know what they're doing with this stuff, but I'm guessing it's something that might just void whatever contracts the GCPS has with the dwarves. I don't care. I'm getting paid. I just like to leave as soon as possible. I'm pocketing the chip when I hear the first impact. There's a heavy thud, it sounds metallic, and the glassware on the dock's shelves rattles a little. There are more thuds, and the lights in the room flicker a little. Then I hear the sounds of alarms. What's that, I say.
The incursion alarm,
says the doc as he runs to the screen mounted above his desk.
We're under attack.
When I got here less than an hour ago, the main landing bay was a picture of order and calm. It's a big space, dominated on one side by a wide rectangular opening, the selective field holding the atmosphere in, but letting small ships through. The site has its own pool of shuttles, and mine was towed over next to some of them for unloading by Wolf's staff. Dozens of workers and various tenders and fuel mechs were going about their business, making repairs and generally keeping the place running, moving stacks of cargo and dock equipment across the broad apron, and guiding shuttles in and out of landing spots. When I get back there, it has become a war zone. Scores of Marines from the site's garrison are hastily deploying two lines of porticades, one a few meters in front of the other, facing the space-side entrance across the apron. The caves are waist-high slabs of metal, and a few heavy weapons are being set up behind the back line. These are not green troops. I recognize many of the command badges some of them wear, including a few fellow Hellview vets. The attack on the site has clearly taken them by surprise as much as everyone else. Most of them are only armed with G-87 rifles. I doubt this kind of thing happens very often. Two piles of burning wreckage on my left are all that's left of the pair of shuttles. My own is somewhere on their far side, but my view is obscured by the smoke, so I have no way of knowing if it's still spaceworthy. There are small fires everywhere across the apron as well. At least five large service mechs are down. One on its side, smoke streaming from the ruined shells towards the atmosphere recyclers in the dock's roof. On the way up here from the lab levels, I could hear more thudding impacts as something pounded the surface of the site. There was the sound of local defense net guns firing too. They have all gone silent now. Safe from the site's guns, a squadron of heavy combat landers is flying through the dock's entrance and find their retros heart as they touch down on a deck, whipping the smoke and debris into thick swirling clouds. I know the lander patterns from a dozen corporal war zones ago, but the troops bursting from their assault ramps are like nothing I've seen before. Just when you think you've done it all, the universe throws something in your face to remind you how dangerous it really is. These things are like animals, but human too. They look like their bones are far too big for their skin, their frames distended and distorted, with spikes of off-white puncturing the joints. They wear torn and worn corporate military uniforms and weapons, but in their eyes is a feral rage and hunger. Some of them take up positions behind the debris of broken tenders and machinery on the deck and fire their weapons, rifles, and grenade launchers at the Marines. Others simply run in mobs towards them, spittle flying from their sharp-toothed mouths and long clawed hands reaching out in front of them. The Marines focus their fire on one of the charging groups, a furious volley that cuts down at least a dozen. The rest keep coming for them. Some of them seem to shrug off the wounds that would drop a human soldier. They swarm over the nearest cave and tear into the five men behind it with tooth and claw. But that isn't the worst thing I see on the battlefield. Behind them come bigger horrors, bigger than a man, bigger than a Terraton even. These things are almost completely covered in plates of bone. It looks organic, but diseased somehow, cancerous, and crested with jagged spikes. Their faces are shockingly human, and I wonder if they are some kind of mutation, the kind of thing they might make in a place like this. There are at least three of them, but they move fast, leaping from side to side, evading the Marine's fire. It is impossible to be sure. I see one mount a cade and grab the first Marine he can, crushing his head in a giant fist. Another Marine is impaled on wicked claws and thrown like a grenade at the team in the next position in the line. The remainder of the team turn and try to run, but it's too late. My eyes meet the horrors of one of those doomed Marines just for a moment, and I see the desperation there. Then he is hauled back by the straps on his webbing, and the leaper fastens his jaws on the back of his neck, severing his spinal cord instantly with a spray of blood and spinal fluid. I have seen enough, too much in fact, and I start crawling. If I can just get to my shuttle, I might still make it out of here, to the Harridan if she is still where I anchored her, anywhere but here. I move along the back line of caves, the sound of battle filling the air around me. I thought I had left all this behind when I rotated into the fleet. But the shouts, the screams, the sound of orders being given and weapons charging and firing is disturbingly familiar, not comforting, just like being home again. I dive across a gap in the cover, laser rounds crackling in the air above my head, and I sprawl on the deck. Before I can get up though, I hear a cry of pain, and then I am flattened as a body falls on top of me. One of the Marines manning the cage I am behind has been hit. His dead weight pins me down. His blood pools around me, making my hands slick as I struggle to get free. Panic threatens to overtake me. I hear a loud explosion from somewhere ahead, from the direction I was heading in before I got stopped. I see under the fuselage of the burning shuttles now. My heart sinks as I realize it was my own ship that's been hit. It might have been just a stray grenade round or a secondary explosion from the other ships, but I can see its crumpled nose and burning forward thrusters, and I know now there's no way I can fly it out of here. I'm trapped in this hell. I lay for a moment cursing the situation, cursing Wolf for bringing me here, but mostly myself and my greed. I knew the risks, and I took the job anyway, and now it's going to kill me. I'm so wrapped up in my anger with myself, I don't realize I'm alone behind the cave until I finally struggle out from under the corpse of the dead Marine. His teammates have run, and I see they're not the only ones. The front line is almost entirely overrun. There were dead and dying everywhere, and a wave of revulsion washes over me as I realize some of the uglies are eating their victims. Then I hear it, a coarse, heavy breathing, a low, bestial growl from somewhere behind me. I turn slowly and look up into the face of death. The leaper crouches on the edge of the cave and leers down at me. It's a beast, savage and primal, with blood on its face and scorch marks on the web of bony armor covering its massive body. I can see now it's got carapace grown out of its musculature, like organic cancerous growths, but somehow out of control. It could be human if it weren't for that. Up close like this, I can see intelligence in bloodshot eyes, too. It knows exactly what it's doing, how terrified I am of it. It's measuring me, enjoying its power over me. Its jaws open, and it begins to reach out one of those terrible clawed hands, as if it's just going to pick me up and consume me at its leisure. Fear grips me, paralyzes me. For a moment there, I nearly let it. But then I realize I've been running from this most of my life. I ran from my home and into the corporate marine uniform. Then I ran from the horrors I saw in service and into flying cargo missions. Always running, and yet still I find myself here. Have I been running in the wrong direction all this time? Before the leaper can grab me, I duck down and pick up the dead marine's weapon. I don't even check to see if it's loaded. I just fire it from a kneeling position, point blank, into the evil thing's ghoulish face. Rage and hatred pour out of me as I shoot. The monster howls as its face disintegrates under the weight of fire, and I scream with it. I let it all go. I won't run away anymore. If I'm gonna die, I'll do it charging. I don't stop firing until all that's left is a smoking crater, and the leaper falls backwards, crashing to the deck on the far side of the cave. Then I strip the grenade pack from the dead marine and hurl it overarm towards a gang of uglies devouring a pile of bodies next to a solid fuel drum, and fire at them with my rifle. I'm lucky. One of the rounds hits something, either the grenades or the fuel, I can't tell which. There's a booming explosion that shakes the deck plating all around me. The uglies are vaporized, and I'm knocked off my feet, stunned for a second by the blast. Did the trick, though. I see the remaining marine teams cheering, and reinforcements start to arrive from elevators behind us. I get back to my feet and move forwards, firing my rifle and shouting old battle cries as I go. Hell view, I shout. The other vets rally behind me, yelling out names of battles they fought in the past, and we advance together. We move forwards, not just trying to hold the line or to escape now. We know we'll probably die here, but still we advance. We will fight, we will win, or die trying. The firefight is furious. Rounds crack past me, around me. One even hits my arm, staggering me, but I don't care. I kill one, two, three uglies, and I can hear more Marines forming up on me, and I keep moving. We're going to retake this bay. We push the uglies back, out of their positions, back towards their ships, and exterminate them, one by one, mob by mob. More men and women do die. The fight is not easy, and the hangar begins to fill with the haze of discharged weapons and broken bodies. But we do it. The lander is destroyed by the combined fire of several heavy weapon teams, just as we kill the last leaper, forcing it into a corner by sheer weight of fire, and then eviscerating it with our rifles and knives. More than 100 Marines start in the battle for this hangar. Maybe 30 of us are still standing now, panting, gasping, covered in sweat and blood, as we look at the smoking, steaming corpses of the things that we finally killed. A ragged cheer goes up as we realize we have won. This round, at least. I look out through the atmosphere field, separating us from the black space outside the site. I can see a dozen ships nearby. Many are civilian, but there are one or two bulkier warships out there, too. Ships like that could carry thousands of troops. Now I know how they got here. I remember the intelligence I saw in the Leaper's eyes. Whatever these things are, they were able to find a GCPS black site, take out its defense net with a preliminary bombardment, and then launch a coordinated assault. Wherever they go next, I hope the Harridan is going in the opposite direction. I know it won't be on here, though. I can see the lights of another line of landers streaming in towards us here on the site. More of these things are coming. Maybe even worse things. We've only minutes before they hear at the bay. A corporal in bloody uniform walks up beside me and salutes. I'm so tired I salute back by instinct. Before I remember, I'm not in uniform and don't really need to.
Sir, what are we gonna do?
He asks. I look at him, at his young face, wearied but ready to go on, not quitting. There are a dozen others behind him, looking at me too, and I smile. I am where I meant to be. Get everyone back into position, I say. We're going to kill them all.
Chapter 6.
Tahushalak paused when he reached the house. The air was cool, and he could hear a flock of blue flitters flying overhead. The carefully curated woodland the house had been built amongst was intended to inspire peace and tranquility, but Tuhu still felt his pulses and core temperature rising. His hand had drifted towards the ornate collar panel beside the doorway, and he let it fall again while he tried to gather his thoughts. It twitched at his side as he recalled one of the mantras his old tutor had taught him at the first monastery in which he had trained. It was decades ago, but still useful now. I am one. The universe is one. I am none. The universe is all. He repeated it to himself, letting his doubts and worries and anxieties fall away from him, letting his conscious mind establish gentle but firm control over his sub-brain as he affirmed his place and purpose in existence. The mantras served him well. They were well rehearsed, and their use had become practically automatic in situations of stress. His internal balance reestablished, he felt the humor in the situation. A Cypher Prime, a commander of the Clades, a warrior who had Cypher drones in some of the most dangerous places in the galaxy, paralyzed at the entrance to a house he barely remembered. He had seen things more horrifying than many other Asterians would even believe was possible. He had killed those things too, and won battles that had preserved balance across the galaxy. So why was coming here the most disturbing thing he could remember experiencing? He stood a moment longer and let his hand rise again and feel the cool stone of the building, tracing the elegant lines of the doorframe. Distant memories hung in the air around this place, like ghosts of the past, like the ones that had brought him here. Another mantra came to his mind. The past is only a ghost, but it weighs heavily on the future. No, he decided. This was just another mission, another small part of a larger campaign. He had his part to play here. The other commanders were relying on him, and he would not be deterred by phantoms. He stood tall and was about to press the call button when the door slid open. Tassim Shuyulak, primary counsel to the Tesseract, and Tuhu's mother, stood in the entrance.
Well, there you are,
she said.
Are you going to come in or just stand there all day?
Tuhu walked in, and the door slid closed behind him. She took him through the house and into the garden at its rear. Tuhu was glad of this, not wanting to be surrounded by familiar layout and furnishings he saw in the living areas as they passed through. There were more religious icons than he remembered from his childhood, displayed prominently on the walls of the hallway, all in their prescribed places, to show his mother's devotion to the Tesseract. Tuhu's experience among the Clades had brought him to believe that the Tesseract was more prosaic than divine. But differences in opinion on the matter were tolerated in Asterian society. Tuhu did not know whether his mother truly believed the Tesseract were gods or not. The Clades believed she had their ear, and that is why they had sent him to her. The gardens were extensive and stretched out from the rear of the house. He could see a pool to one side he had swum in as a boy, and the high rock platforms to one side he had loved to jump from. His mother had urged him not to. She had been so protective of him then, before she had abandoned him completely. He found himself resentful of these things, features he recognized from his youth, the things she had kept and preserved while she rejected him. He knew it was all a natural thing. All males were sent out by their mothers eventually. His true male father had taken him in then, recognized his potential, and enrolled him in the monastery for training as a warrior. Tuhu was glad of that too. His neuter male father was a diplomat, and Tuhu did not believe he could develop the restraint and tact necessary for mingling openly with aliens. But none of his success in his assigned path in life could reduce the sting of coming back here. They walked through the grove of fruit trees in pink blossom, and Tuhu tried to calculate what season this planet was currently experiencing. He decided it was likely the trees were kept in that state perpetually, preserving the beauty of the scene all year round. On their far side was a low hillock, and at its summit, an ornate pavilion that appeared grown as much as built. Curling loops and swirls of vines grew on and around the graceful stone columns that supported a gently sloping roof, It was the perfect mix of artifice and nature. As they climbed the hill, the obscuring devices and interference fields built into the pillars and supports diffused and refracted the light from the sun setting on its far side, making it seem to glow with a spectral halo. They would meet in the open, yet be completely hidden from any observers. Entering the pavilion, Tuhu's vision blurred slightly, and he felt a tingling sensation pass through his head and his extremities. A serving drone met them within, carrying a tray of elegant earthenware, and they knelt on either side of the low table. The drone laid out the bowls and cups and steaming pitcher of water, and Tassim began the ritual to make tea. Not the blood blue tea for friends or recreation, Tuhu noted as she placed a portion of leaves in a wide bowl, but crimson, the tea for colleagues and official visitors.
Was your mission successful?
She asked as she poured the water over the leaves. He paused for a moment, letting his vision settle as he watched the swirls of steam rise from the tea and dissipate into the air. All things pass. Nothing is constant.
Yes,
he said.
Yes, it was.
His mother's head bowed in supplication, acknowledging the Tesseract and their watch over the galaxy. Tuhu found he did not care to show the same devotion.
Useful data?
I believe so. The analysts on my ship tell me it will enable the war minds to predict much more accurately the movements of at least a dozen of the four Taurus fleets. When combined with the data from other observer clades, that is.
He allowed.
Good. I am glad.
She finished the ritual now and poured the tea from its bowl into two small porcelain cups. She placed one in front of Tuhu and raised the other to her own pale lips. Tuhu lifted his own cup, the delicate object feeling awkward in his powerful hands. He held it in front of his face, but could not make himself drink the red liquid. The gesture was enough, though. His mother sipped at hers, and they replaced the cups on the table.
And was it the war minds that set you here today?
She asked. Tuhu felt his ire rising in his gut, but he remained completely still. He should not have been surprised. The war minds were not the only ones able to think strategically.
Not directly,
he said.
But my brothers in the clades believe your ears may be receptive to their, to my case. I come as a messenger to you, and I hope to the Tesseract also by your will.
She raised her delicate eyebrows at that. Perhaps she had expected him to be less direct. Tuhu imagined that she would be used to this from her time as a politician. But then, that is why he had been chosen for this task. He would say things perhaps no other Asterion could.
And deliver your message,
she said.
Very well. The wardship we had observed sent out a smaller vessel, but our navigator could not assess its destination. It seemed not to be heading towards any inhabited systems or no trade. So, I took the decision to follow it. I met with a GCPS vessel, and we believe it delivered a considerable quantity of armor for the humans, force program, and their wreck.
And you know this how?
We were able to send a Spectre program into the Forge Father ship and retrieve several quads of data from its computer, including builds of blading and shipping manifests.
You risk much,
she said.
I did,
he confirmed.
But I believe the risk was warranted. We were not detected.
How can you be certain?
There was no reason for the dwarfs to even suspect we were present. The approaches we used were beyond their capacity to detect normally, anyway. And
he hesitated, thinking through the level of sophistication of dwarf sensors.
Even if they did suspect our presence, I doubt they would be able to find us. They think themselves masters of technology, but we are merely more advanced than their human puppets.
Tassim looked outside the pavilion towards the setting sun. It cast a warm amber glow across the lawns as shadows started to grow from the trees and bushes surrounding the pavilion.
Very well, but in these things, as in all, you must take great care. The humans have the word which I believe we would do well as a species to adopt. It is called hubris.
Her mouth twisted at the awkward syllables of the human language.
It means to take too much confidence from one's abilities and therefore be at risk of great harm when they fail. Of all the races in the galaxy, we ought to take note of this the most.
Tihu noted his mother's thoughtful tone and understood the reference, even though he did not appreciate the use of the human word to express it. She was right. The Asterian Star Empire had once been the mightiest power in known history, until it reached too far for its own good.
I accept your warning,
he said.
Now, let me give you mine. I decided to follow the human ship, or rather, the equipment it was carrying. We have found it forces to be a competent adversary. In battle, and any intelligence on their disposition is highly valuable to the Clades. The human vessel took her to some kind of research facility, well hidden, constructed inside one of the asteroids in the Pony sector. I believe this was one of the locations for their attempts to break the safeguards the dwarves build into the things they give the corporation.
And were you able to learn anything from this asteroid base?
Sadly, no. The location was attacked before we could penetrate its defenses.
By?
The Scourge. A fleet of ships. Mostly human and civilian in origin. But with enough warships to support their assault.
The words hung in the air between them, heavy and cold. The light from the sun had gone completely now, and several lamps, rendered beautifully as organic shapes, like growing fruit, came to life. Their light could not lift the dark mood that prevailed the pavilion now, though.
Was the Scourge contained?
I do not know. We departed the system when three ships belonging to the Enforcer arrived and immediately engaged the enemy. It would have been unwise to risk being caught in their fire and exposed. At least some humans may have escaped the place, though. We did report several small ships leaving it before the arrival of the Enforcers. My brothers and the Clades wish me to tell you that either way, we believe open conflict is now inevitable and imminent. Other ghost missions are reporting a massing of war machines in both the Human Corps and their expansion worlds. Our spies report their corporation's plans to annex more of the world we left to the Scourge. They do not understand the danger buried there and ignore the warnings of the practice. They meddle with the toys the Forge Fathers give them too, because they do not understand how dangerous or how treacherous their allies truly are. Contrary to what I may have suggested earlier, I do not underestimate the power of the Forge Lords at all, or their threat to our borders. They are certainly less capable than ourselves in many areas, but they have had time to prepare, to build arsenals. They did not have to deal with the Scourge and have numbers in greed to match the corporation. They had designs on the entire galaxy, including our own space. And there are other threats too. Other races readying themselves to rise and fill the spaces left by any carnage unleashed upon the galaxy. You talk about the dangers of the hubris. Well, I tell you, we are now more guilty of timidity. We respect the balance in all things. But if we cannot see the universe is truly out of balance now, if the Tesseract will not allow us to act to address it, then when will we? After this meeting, I am due to report to the War Mine on all this.
Tihu said.
I do not believe the news of a fleet of scourge ships will be well received.
Tassim smiled at her son then. It was only a thin crescent of an expression, but still an unfamiliar one to Tuhu.
I think your news will not be as momentous as you expect. It will not be the first of its kind.
Tuhu placed his hands on the table edge.
You mean there are others?
She nodded.
Then surely you must agree the time has come.
For war?
Yes. The Clays demand it. They sent me here to ask you to use your influence with the Tesseract, to make them see the necessity of it.
But against whom?
He hesitated, then sat back. His stance had become aggressive, leaning in and gripping the table with his fingers. It was the kind of thing you could do in a meeting with other primes, or with his secondaries when planning a raid, but not at a meeting with a council, or his mother. He dipped his head slightly, in acknowledgement of his poor form, and Tassim lowered her eyes in acceptance.
You should deliver your report as you intended,
she said, taking up her cup again.
It is, though, as I said, not the first of its kind. Our agents amongst the humans report their plans to us, and the Tesseract knows we stand on the brink. But we must be careful now more than ever. The threats to the universe are numerous, and any one of them could turn and devour us if we provoke it carelessly.
Tuhu felt his frustration rising again. He had heard these sentiments before 1,000 times, in the debating chambers of the Tesseract. The military and civilian leaders had argued the points again and again, one side demanding war, the other advocating for watchful peace. And meanwhile, the universe around them grew more dangerous every day. Tuhu heard a chiming noise then, a sound in his right ear, gentle but urgent. The Clades were calling. He bowed his head towards his mother.
I apologize. I am being summoned and must go now.
Of course,
she said.
I will consider what you have told me,
she said, as Tuhu rose from the table.
Please know, although many agents report to me, I do consider your own word particularly valuable. Inform the Clades I will pass on their recommendation. Tell them.
Tassim lowered her eyes.
I am aware of the weight of the ghost of the past.
As he stood, Tuhu saw his mother had adopted a different stance, her limbs moving into an expression he could not immediately decipher. The world around her was starting to go gray, the sounds becoming distant, and he felt a sense of vertigo as he realized it was one of embarrassment. His usually stoic mother had expressed a sentiment of attachment and could not bear it.
I wish we could one day.
Before she could finish, Tuhu's consciousness left the host drone it had been transferred to, completely, and he found himself back aboard his ship, being gently lifted in low light from the sentience pod he had used to transmit himself to his homeworld. His real flesh body seemed cumbersome and heavy, and his limbs flailed as a triad of attendants helped him to his feet and began to clean him of the fluids from the pod. He felt impatience as well as disorientation, and he strove to avoid disassociation, the complete loss of the connection between his mind and real body. He felt it every time he closed the interface with his cipher, and was not surprised to be experiencing it after being joined with the communicator proxy he had just used now. The vast distance involved was immaterial. The quantum technology employed made it so, but the strain on his psyche was still immense. The attendants dressed him in his uniform, and he walked to the ship's command center, thinking over his conversation with his mother, the council, and her last words to him. 12 other primes were waiting for him there. He wasted no time with superfluous greetings. Those things were not necessary amongst a gathering such as this. These were all true males, leaders and commanders, and they all knew why they were here. Instead, he took a seat at their head and laid his hands on the table before him.
My brothers,
he said,
ready your forces. We are now on the path to war.
Epilogue.
In the darkened office, high above the city of lights, a lone figure sat at a heavy wooden desk. The only light in the room came from the scrolling holographic feeds projected from hidden generators in the desk's surface. The only noise came from the reader's sleeves as she manipulated the projections with waves of her hands. Only 7 people in the universe had access to so much data, so many feeds from all over the GCPS and beyond in real time. But the feeds from the market and reports from analysts and commodity speculators were not what held the reader's attention this morning. With a flick of one wrist, she minimized the financial reports, and with the other, pulled up the communique she had received from ISO an hour earlier. At the bottom of the report, in glowing green letters, it said commit or reserve. She knew the other 6 would have received identical reports and be facing the same choice as she was. Asterian spies were not novel, nor was Forge Father duplicity, but the latest in analysis, the data presented in this latest report of Veerman numbers and movements was alarming. And the plague, containment appeared had not been sufficient. The whole black site was gone. Not even all the people working there had known exactly where it was, and yet the plague had found it and destroyed it. She made a mental note to ruin the careers of the scientists who had told her, told them all, that the rat men were a mere nuisance, part of the price of doing business with the universe. She had argued against containment, too, once, in the past, but she could not touch the people who had outvoted her on that one. But this vote would need to be unanimous. Its consequence would, after all, touch the entire GCPS, possibly the entire galaxy. Commit or reserve? Tango Epsilon Ruhilla. Just a few of the battalions waiting the decision of the Council. Some were training battalions, some more experienced, but all of them created with only one purpose. Really, there was no choice. She activated the secure and unique identification implants in her palm and held it over the scanner beneath the displays. Then, with one finger, she tapped the single glowing word that would send those men and women to war. The system collated her vote with those of the others and immediately relayed the results to the Corps Command. Within minutes, across corporate space and far beyond it, 1,000 commanders received new orders and began to deploy their forces accordingly.